Well, we have the pleasure of having a guest speaker this morning, Sally Breen. Sally, if you want to come up to the stage here. Sally and her husband, Mike, are from South Carolina. And yesterday, they led us in a workshop on family on mission, how to engage with friends and the idea of sharing in God's movement in the neighborhood to try and join in what God is doing and take part as a community. A number of years ago, when KITS was first beginning, Sally and Mike wrote a book around how small groups can be constructed around moving out into the neighborhood, and we've used that to help equip our small groups here at KITS, which has been a great gift and a great tool, so thanks for that, Sally. So let's pray for Sally and for our hearts to be open towards God as she comes to teach us this morning. Jesus, even now, we would open up our lives towards you. Come and in that space, speak. And may our lives be receptive to your life-giving and life-forming word. Come and bless Sally today. May she be a mouthpiece for your words. And may we all be able to share in your good blessing as through our shared experience, your spirit is present. For we pray in your name. Amen.
Well, good morning. It's lovely to be here with you. I'm enjoying Vancouver. It is a beautiful city. I'm going to try this up here. In case you didn't know, Mike and I travel a lot, and this is one of the most beautiful cities. Mike says it's his favorite Pacific Rim city, which makes it sound very... I don't even know what the Pacific Rim is, Mike. But anyway, it is a beautiful city, particularly if you go onto Willow and you can see, you look down that road and you can see the mountains and you can see the skyscrapers. It's amazing. So thank you for hosting me and Mike here this weekend. We've had a wonderful time yesterday with a lot of your leaders, bringing you the message of our lives, which is Family on Mission, which for many years we didn't have a name for. We were just doing it through disaster and failure, and then eventually we came up with the name Family on Mission. That for the last 20, 25 years, we've been doing life that way, and I can't imagine doing life, discipleship, and ministry any other way. And basically, it's just moving. I haven't got time to tell you all about what Family on Mission is, but the quick sort of 10-second soundbite is that it's a way of doing life together that we believe the early Christians did through an extended family. And it was through that model of oikos, an extended family, that the early church was able to resist persecution and was able to grow despite persecution. Historians tell us, especially Rodney Stark, that that is the single most significant factor in the growth of the early church. And they did that in a way to minister and disciple and to do mission to others. And we have taken that on as a principle and as a practice in our lives. And we call it Family on Mission. So for some of us, that will be a new concept, moving as a tribe, moving as an extended family. However, throughout the world, this is a very, very common experience. I had the privilege of going to Haiti a few months after the earthquake, and discovered there, when I spoke to the people there who had suffered great hardship and terrible tragedy, I said, "How did you survive?" And they said, "We survived because of our extended family. If we hadn't have had extended family..." And they have a special name for that, which I can't remember, so I'm sorry. But through that unit, they were able to survive the earthquake that hit them. And I want to give you a quote from an African saying, which is one that is very dear to my heart. The African proverb says, "If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together." And I truly believe that. I want to go far, and so I believe that by going together as an extended family, I'm able to do that more fully. This morning, in particular, I want to look at the passage from Ruth. I love the story of Ruth and Naomi. It's a wonderful, well-known story, and I've read it for many, many years. I think I probably like it for a couple of reasons. I like it because it's two women, and I like it because they're extremely brave and courageous. And I also like it because they're very practical. And I am essentially, first and foremost, a very practical person. So Mike comes up with all the theology and all the spirituality, and I'm like, but does it really work? Will it work every day over the kitchen table? Will it work with two children under four when they're ill? Will it work, Mike? So that's my gift to Mike. And I hope that it's my gift to you. And so I love the fact that these women are essentially practical as well as spiritual. And so I'm going to unpack that a little bit and talk about some principles that I've discovered that I always look at in my life when I hear God talking to me. And I hope you find those useful. The other reason that I love this story of Naomi and Ruth is that within our extended family, we have a Ruth. We have somebody that we identify as the Ruth within our family. And his name is Gavin. So, slight turn on that. He is married to our daughter, Libby, our second child, who is now 30 years old. But 8 years ago, he wasn't married to her. And he was just vaguely interested in her, you know. And she'd known him from high school. And he started to ask her out on some dates. Now, our daughter had made some mistakes in her dating life. She would not mind me giving you that information. And so she was a little bit more cautious than she had been perhaps in the past. And so when Gavin said to her, "Will you go on a date?" she was like, "You're nice, but you're not in the same place as me. You're not quite on the same faith place." And he said something very interesting. He said, "If this is so important to you, will you let me investigate it?" So he investigated it. She was in America, he was in England. He investigated it. And to cut a long story short, at the end of that, he became a Christian and he asked her to marry her. Nice story. However, what she actually said is, "If I say yes," which I want to say yes to you. I love you and I really want to say yes. "However, I come as a package. I am part of an extended family. I am going to live in America. I work for my parents. We work as a family on mission. This is the deal. If you can't take it, goodbye now." She's a very strong woman, I have to say. Anyway, she takes after her father. Anyway, he said, "Yes, where you go, I go. Your family is now my family, and I will follow you," which is amazing. And what he also didn't know is that as he said that, and he said back to his parents in England, "I'm going to marry Libby. We're going to move to America. I've become a Christian. This is the direction of the rest of my life," that they would disown him. They completely and utterly disowned him. And they didn't come to the wedding. So it was at a great cost that we have Gavin. Now, the good news is, through grace and through redemption and through forgiveness, they have restored that relationship, and so it's all good. But, so we have a Ruth, and I'm going to read this passage to you. I think you have it in your bulletin, but these are the favorite words that I love. So it's from Ruth 1, 16 to 19. So the story is, in case any of you don't know, is that basically these three women have been all widowed. Naomi was widowed first, and then the two daughter-in-laws were widowed. We have no idea why, but that's what happened. And so they're left. And Naomi decides, because she hears good news about the way that her homeland in Bethlehem and Judea is happening, things are good there, she wants to go back there. And so she begins to say to her daughter-in-laws, "I'm going back there, but you go back home." And Orpah, I always want to call her Oprah, but anyway, Orpah, decides that that's what she'll do. She chooses a very realistic route. She goes back to her home for protection and stability. However, Ruth says this. She says, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" And the story goes on, whereby it's a beautiful example of Naomi discipling Ruth in both her traditions and in her faith. And I think most of us will be aware that the end of that story, a kinsman redeemer through the traditions of that community came forward and redeemed their situation and brought Ruth to be his bride. And the end result was that Naomi got a grandson, and the history and thereon in, you know, is the rest of the story. But I love certain elements about this. I love the fact that it's a very clear description of the way Naomi disciples Ruth in the things that she's not familiar with. I love it because of its concreteness. They didn't just sit there and go, "Woe is me." They did something practical. And as I said before, I love practical. And so, what I have noticed when God calls us to make big moves or to do changes in our lives, or we begin to hear his stirrings in our spirit, there are usually three areas that need examining in our heart, in our lives. And the first that I want to address is our household and our home. I love houses. I have had probably 37 houses in 38 years of marriage. That's a lot of houses. And we have done a quick audit of our family, of our biological children and us. And we have moved a total of, any guesses? 127 times. That's a lot of boxes and a lot of moving and a lot of planning. And we are a very pioneering apostolic family, and so I actually like to move. I'm one of those strange people. We moved to Greenville a year and a half ago, and then 3 months ago, we moved again. We actually just moved next door. Because why not? I like moving. But I love houses. I love decorating them. I love interior design. I love making them hospitable. Through our times of ministry, we've had thousands and thousands and thousands of people through our home. But one of the things that I've noticed is that part of the way God speaks and what God uses in our lives are our homes and our households. And so I take frequent stock of my home and household and say, is it actually being used for the most effective use for the kingdom and for what God's calling us for? Is there an abundance of rooms that aren't being used properly? Are there things in this home or household that I'm holding on to that actually are just sentimental? I love, you know, the big purge, the black bags, getting everything out, you know, all that. And I do it as a spiritual discipline, because I want to be able to travel light. I don't want to be held by those things, and I don't want to be put restrictions on what the Lord can do with me just because of this stuff that I have in my life. And so as God speaks at different stages, I always say to him, is my house ready? Is it ready for the next move that you have? And I don't necessarily mean physical move. I mean for the move of what God is doing. And it may be something very simple. As I said, we moved to Greenville a year and a half ago, and we'd previously lived in a very large, expansive house that could house lots of people and host over 100 people for dinner. So it was a very big house. It was an amazing gift. We then felt the call to move to Greenville. We were moving as an extended family. Our children were moving. We no longer needed to be in Pawleys Island. We moved to this great place called Greenville, South Carolina. And Mike and I felt that we should move to the city. We're basically urban people. We like urban landscapes. I like messy, ugly places. And so South Carolina and Pawleys Island is not a messy, ugly place. It's a beautiful beach resort. And so I was feeling a lack of diversity and just sort of urban grit. And so we chose to live downtown, but the only accommodation we could find was a quarter of the size of the house that we were living in. So we said, okay, that's what we've been given. That's clearly where we should go. There were people of peace in that neighborhood that welcomed us, and we squashed our stuff into this tiny little house. But I forgot something really essential. In my rush to do it and to fulfill that quest, I realized that I had accidentally not left really enough space for a dining room table. And I had accidentally bought, I don't know why, I must have had some sort of delusional moment, but anyway, I'd bought sort of like a garden table that was sort of antique-y and was meant to be nice, but it was a sort of circular table with three iron chairs, and it sat in this little space in our kitchen, living room, diner thing. And I basically discovered one day that I didn't like it. And the reason that I wasn't inviting people over was because that I didn't like it. It didn't feel like my kitchen table. It didn't feel like a place that I could do conversations and prayer and ministry. And so one day, well, Mike was away, and of course this always happens when Mike's away. I moved it out and bought something else. It wasn't a surprise to him. I made a kitchen table out of an IKEA desk and some legs. But anyway, I was pleased with it. My children tell me it was a bit unstable, but I was quite pleased with it. It looked better. And I could sit at it. And I discovered that it changed the way I felt. It meant that I actually wanted people to come into the house again. And so my question to you this morning is there something in your house or household that just needs changing for you to move into more fully what God is doing? What Naomi and Ruth had to do was they had to surrender their home and household in the place that they had been living to enable Lee to fully grasp the future of their lives. If they'd stayed with the security of the household they had, where they were safe and they knew people, instead of moving into this unknown and hoping and praying for a Kinsman Redeemer, they would have been a lot less, and the story would have been very different. The second thing that I always look at is hands. I look at my hands. First of all, I look at what have I got in my hands? What are my hands already full of? Are they full of the busyness of the day? Are they full of the things that I'm holding on to? Are they full of the things that I've got my fists tightly clenched around that I'm unable to let go of to be able to pick up what God is wanting me to do? In the case of Naomi and Ruth, Ruth actually had to work with her hands. She had to go in the fields, she had to open up her hands, and she had to gather the grain. if she had had her hands full of other stuff, and I don't know what they may have been, they may have been prejudice. They may have been a feeling that I'm too good to do this. I was not born to actually go gathering the leftovers in the fields. But what she did was she embraced both what her mentor, Naomi, was telling her, and in turn what the Lord was telling her, and she went to work in the fields. And I love that. It's so practical. In my time in leadership and ministry, when anybody ever says to me, they say to me, what would you describe leadership as? I say two things, hard work and lasagna. Because basically, over the last 30-odd years, I have made hundreds and hundreds of pans of lasagna. And I have fed hundreds and hundreds of people through crock pots. I don't really like cooking. Anybody who really knows me, I don't really like cooking. So I do the crock pot, slow cooker, whatever you call it here in Canada, and throw a few tins in and put it on and hope it turns out okay. Throw in a bit of wine for good measure and it covers it all. Okay, you know what I mean, don't you? Those meals that you just plug in and, you know, pray over and hope for the best. I've done lots of those with lots of people eating them going, hope it goes far enough. I hope it's tasty enough. I hope it's cooked enough. Anyway, and then there's a lot of trash picking up. There's basically a lot of clearing up. It's just a lot of hard work. And in Christian sort of circles at the moment, you hear a lot about dreams and passions. What's your dream? What's your passion? And me and my daughters, who often are helping me, either my spiritual daughters or my biological daughters and sons, as we sit there, you know, with the leftovers, lasagnas and the black bags, we go, yeah, this was really my dream. This was my passion. I was always hoping that what I would do would be serving all these people and then clearing up after them. But it's true. It's needed. A lot of ministry and calling is just hard work. And so my challenge is, what represents your hands in your life? What are you not willing to put them to do because you're holding on to something else? What if you put down something and pick something new up? Would there be a new adventure for you? The last thing is the heart. Now, I know for certain that Naomi and Ruth's hearts were broken. They had become widows. They had suffered a massive amount of grief and loss, both of status, security. The men that they loved had gone from them. And all of us in our lives have suffered loss. We may not have suffered the loss of a person, but we may have suffered the loss of an expectation, something that we thought would happen. We may have lost jobs or relationships or life things that we thought would always be there but are no longer there. Very few of our lives turn out exactly how we planned, or at least I've never met anybody. My life is not how I planned when I was 16. It's entirely different. It's much better, it's much broader, but there has been loss and a cost, and I think it's important to acknowledge that. But as you embark on a new journey, you have to look at your own heart. You have to say, is my heart open to the new thing? I have an amazing example of this from our own lives, because they're the closest to me. Our daughter, our other daughter, not the one with the husband who's Ruth, who's Gavin, okay? We have another daughter. She's 32 years old, and her name is Rebecca. She's our firstborn child, and she has been married to her husband, Phil, for 9 years. They got married 9 years ago. He's American, and they embarked on a journey. Their journey of marriage was not an easy one, but at the end of that, they decided to have children, and they suffered infertility. So that was a big, major hurdle. Our daughter had always wanted children, and they suffered infertility. So any of you who have experienced that, you know there is a massive amount of grief with that. They got pregnant with the help of medical aid, with twins, and then she miscarried those at 12 and 13 weeks. Massive loss. Then, unexpectedly and miraculously, without any medical intervention, she became pregnant with a little boy. And everything was going amazing, and she was 23 weeks pregnant when she suffered an overwhelming life-threatening illness. She had three life-threatening illnesses. I can only remember the name of two of them because the other one is so medical that I can't pronounce it. But anyway, she had HELLP, if any of you know that, which is where your whole body goes into meltdown and all your major organs fail. And so basically they said, you have a choice. You will either die or we can take the baby by cesarean section. And so she said, we'll go for the cesarean. They said the survival rate in this hospital of babies born at this age is very, very good. It's 90%. Great survival rate. We were there with her. I saw her as she recovered. Oliver was born, and he looked, to all intents and purposes, really, really healthy. He was a good weight. Everything was going well. But she was failing, and we thought during that next week that we would lose her three times. She was at death's door three times, and I had a conversation with her, which is one that you never want with your daughter at the bedside of a hospital, which is, are you okay? Is there anything you want to say to me if this is your last hours? And she said, I know where I'm going, Mom. I'm fine. I know you'll look after Oliver. I know you'll take care of Phil. I'm good. Don't worry. And I'm like, don't worry? Good grief. Anyway, I know. And so what happened is that we had people around the world praying. The tables turned. She survived and Oliver died. Unexpectedly, very suddenly, she was able to hold him as he died, but he died. And that loss, I thought, would break her. I just thought it would break her. And the most amazing thing about it is that it didn't. It didn't break her. It actually made her stronger. She dug down deep into her faith, and she believed 100% that she heard that she would have a family. She said, I know I will be a mother. It may be in 20 years, and it may be to a 14-year-old, but I know that I will be a mother. And I went, I'm with you. I believe it too. I'm faithful for this, Rebecca. I know you will be a mother. And what she did was something that I think is singly the most bravest act I've ever heard anybody do. And I'll share it with you, even though she's my daughter, because I think it's amazing. And I'm so proud of her. 2 months after the loss of Oliver, she decided to go and join a mothers and babies group. I know. And she walked into that and she said, I am a mother, but I am a mother who has lost her child. I want to be around other mothers because they bring me hope. I know, incredible. And she is not a naturally brave person, I can tell you that. But she felt certain that this was what she was called to do. The amazing story that I'm actually getting to is the fact that what happened is about 2 weeks before the anniversary of the death of Oliver, she received an adopted baby, a brand new baby. She was there at the birth of him, and she has now Jackson, a wonderful 2-year-old, and she has an open adoption. She decided that instead of closing her heart through grief and loss, she said, I want to express the love and generosity outwards. I want to expand our family and include the birth mother in our family because she is giving me this amazing gift of a child, which is incredible. And then about 3 months ago, maybe only 8 weeks ago, she is a member of a church team. She's a children's worker. And somebody walked into that church and said, my daughter is pregnant. She's 20 years old. She wants the baby to be adopted by somebody within this faith community. Do you know of anybody? And guess whose hand went up first? My daughter's, Becky. And she went home to her husband and went, I think I may have just got us another child. I don't know what it is. I don't know what colour it is. I don't know whether it's healthy, but I just said yes. And over the last 8 weeks, she has got to know the birth mother. She has been discipling her. She is included in her family. And she was there again at the birth 2 weeks ago of our latest granddaughter, Bethany, Bethany Joy. And so I think this is a wonderful example of how she and her husband could have closed their heart through grief and loss. But instead, through hearing God's word, she decided to expand her heart and include other people into her family and to express God's love by going bigger and broader and wider. And we see that time and time again. Throughout the Bible and through this story, they didn't decide to stay where they were in grief and loss. They decided to open up their hearts to the possibility of a new future. And I don't know where any of you are. I don't know you as people. You all look lovely, but I don't know you. But I do know that you will have all suffered in some level, grief and loss. It's a human condition. And my encouragement to you would be to hear again the voice of the Lord and what he's saying to you about that and whether it's time to open up your heart again. And so I'm drawing to a conclusion. And I don't know whether it's your household, your hands, or your heart that is challenged this morning. But I was challenged by something that I read about just a few weeks ago in the news. And he is a Canadian. I may pronounce this wrongly, so please excuse me because I'm not from Canada. But there is a guy called Jim Estill of Guelph. Is it called Guelph? In Ontario. Okay. Have any of you heard of him? Okay, you want to read up about him. His name is Jim Estill of Guelph. He heard about the plight of the Syrian refugees, and he said, not on my watch. And he's a wealthy businessman, and he said, okay, I'm going to see what I can do. What can I do about this? I don't want this moment in history to pass without me doing something. So he did the research. And he found out that if he gave $1.5 million, which clearly is a lot of money, but anyway, $1.5 million, he could bring into Canada 55 Syrian families. And he has rescued 220 individuals. But he didn't do it by himself, by just writing the check. He embraced the whole town. He gathered the whole town under his vision, and he has 800 people in the town of Guelph, which who knows there was anywhere called that, but anyway, Guelph. And they have received these 220 refugees. They have found them jobs and housing and accommodation, well, housing is accommodation, and education, and they give them training in what being a Canadian means, and he has done it as a family on mission. This is his mission, to rescue Syrian refugees. They come into his home. He feeds them. He does his home, his hands, and his heart to fully embrace what God has asked him to do. And I encourage you to read up about him. It's amazing. And so I want to end with that, which is, I don't know what God is saying to you in this moment, either today, this morning, this week, or this year. But I do want you to listen. And then after you've heard what God says, I want you to do something about it. Thank you.